White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network. Your host for today's show is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy. So get a spot of tea, sit down and relax, because it's time for another show on the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network.
Yes, White Aryan Resistance calling. This is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker in north central Indiana on a pretty cool morning, but I think it's up in the 40s already, so that's not bad at all. Not bad at all. And it's December the 18th, 2014. Yeah. And we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations for the show. And if you don't have yours in now, you're in trouble, baby. We usually keep up to the 15th as a cutoff date. So if it goes much longer than that, well, you might find yourself cut off until you catch up. You know, we're hard ass. We're hard ass here. I have to sit down here in this creepy old dungeon every day. Igor, he stinks like hell. The cobwebs in the corner, chickens in the rafters, and all that kind of stuff. Pound out this stuff of at least a couple hours, maybe 3 hours a day. Yeah. So I got to shake you down. Got to shake you down to, so we can finance some of these things and get some money orders off to the POWs about once a month. Yeah. Okay, here we go. You ready? This is the day. Oh, guess what? We're going to talk about Uncle Adolf. Yeah, it's the 2014. You'd think it'd about almost be over, but there's still people debating about Uncle Adolf. Well, we're going to add some more grist to the mill here, okay? Well, I've got three or four or five books here in my library that go against the grain, against the left and the right, on who was Adolf Hitler. That's the negative. Then I've got quite a few, of course, pro-Hitler books in my library that don't tell near as much about him as we'd like to know. So anyhow, the author of the book that I'm going to refer to, which I've had now for about 30 years, and I tended to poo-poo it and set it aside because everybody on the right, which I used to be a part of, oh no, that's a terrible book. Oh no, that's not true. That's a lie. So I used to find people in the right wing once in a while I had respect for, that I felt that they're intellect and research capabilities were beyond mine. But now I've come full circle because many questions started cropping up in my mind because the 6 million, we know that's fake. We don't know how many Jews died. There were a lot of them, maybe a few hundred thousand, maybe like the Red Cross said, 200,000 or something like that. Very possible in a war that took the lives of 55 million people that these people concentrated in certain areas in the middle of a war zone are going to get tromped no matter what, like everybody else. The author of the book I'm going to refer to is Adolf Hitler, the founder of Israel. Written by Kardel, K-A-R-D-E-L. He was the son of a German scientist, Rudolf Kardel, After completing Army Academy, he served as an infantryman in the German Army in Russia and the Balkans. In 1979, he was sued. Now, this is interesting because I want you to use common sense and analytical powers that I know you have. In 1979, he was sued by the German state, which also confiscated all his possessions. In 1982, he was acquitted without any expenses paid. That in itself is interesting. He actually wrote two books. I didn't write down the title of the other one, but he died in 2007. Wait a minute, I think I do have it here. Well, I guess this other one was the same book, maybe in German, because it says Hitler Verrat am National Socialism. So whether that's a different book, I'm not quite sure. Well, it's a different book, but maybe it's just the same book in German. But anyhow, well, let's get going because this is going to take a while. I may run some of you people off, but this quest about Hitler gets to be a very time-consuming, and the right wing just keeps going on and on with how what a wonderful guy he was. Well, I don't believe anybody in power can be said is or was a wonderful guy, because they have all kinds of good points and all kinds of bad points, and that's what I pointed out about Hitler. And so from time to time I slide one way and then I slide the other way. But I'm beginning to, after a lot of information, I'm beginning to slide more into the anti-Hitler camp. I read you the preface the other day. Now we'll go into the... Did I do the introduction? I think I did the introduction. If not, I can come back and do it later. If anybody's listening, by now you probably went to the kitchen and got a beer. On a humid, cold afternoon of April 20th, 1889, a cry was heard from the Inn of Pommer, P-O-M-M-E-R, in Braunau, on the River Inn. On the first floor, a young wife of 50-year-old Imperial Royal Customs officer of Austria-Hungary had borne a son. This cry was bound to become considerably stronger throughout the first half of our century and shall end no earlier than he, who was born on this day and shot himself through his vociferous mouth in the ruins of the State Chancellery, Berlin, 1945. His lifelong discontent and his constant rage over their origin, it can be said, in an obviously unfortunate mixture of two nations. First one, then the other, believing that they were chosen by God or Providence, Jews and Germans, no one else but you I want to put above all other nations. His proud father of that day was out of wedlock and for 40 years carried his mother's maiden name, Schickelgruber. One evening he grumbled through the mustache of his customs colleagues, quote, as of tomorrow, you shall call me Hitler, unquote. Some other time, three old illiterate men were sent to the village pastor near their hometown, and one after another swore that the man who died 20 years earlier was Johann George Heidler, the one who had married Madame Schickelgruber. And before he died, he always wanted to adopt Alois Adolf Hitler's father. This remarkable statement was documented by the honorable pastor and by the three men from the forest who had confirmed this by subscribing the document with X marks. Then the customs officer changed the Heidler name, sometimes called Hitler, now Hutler, H-U-E-T-T-L-E-R, into the common Jewish name Hitler. Therefore, on the April 20th, a newborn citizen received the name Hitler, and he was called Adolf. Or later, mainly by the girls, Wolf, and still later, plainly and simply, Mein Führer, or my leader. The half-Jewish general governor of Poland, Hans Frank, Hitler's lawyer during the war, who was hung in Nuremberg shortly before his execution, revealed that he knew about Hitler's Jewish origin. About this, it was written in the book In the Face of the Gallows. See reference 42 in that book. To the Hitler researcher, Maser, a pupil of the communist Nikesh, Frank's death cell confession was meant to counteract any future anti-Catholic arguments. Quote, how come before the execution he made such a heavy-weighted allegation, probably under a tough care of the American military, Catholic priest? Sixtus O'Connor in Nuremberg, he ostensibly presented himself as a remorseful and religious person in order to distance, in the future, all Catholics from the multimillion murderer Adolf Hitler, and thus to inflict upon the Jews restlessness, insecurity, and consciousness of guilt. And there are people who take Maser's wild speculation seriously. Adolf's father, the customs officer, Alois Hitler, originates from the Austrian forests close to the Czechoslovakian border, where even a fox and a hare live in peace together. He studied to be a shoemaker, but did not pursue his trade for long. However, at the age of 18, he joined the promising financial enterprise in Vienna, which ran quite well. He was an intelligent lad whose frequent promotions changed his position. Kind-heartedly, he boarded his 13-year-old niece, Clara Poltz, who also came from this village. Later, when his second wife was dying, he got Clara pregnant, and after that, she became his third wife. She gave him 6 children, but only 2 survived. Adolf and the younger sister, Paula, when her brother became successful, she managed one of his households. Occasional business trips of the Imperial Royal Customs Officer, Alois Hitler, to Vienna, resulting mostly in illegitimate children of his, in those days a very literal city. In 1936, in Switzerland, Hitler's biographer, Conrad Haydn, revealed about his Austrian part of the forest that one of the Führer's ancestors on his mother's side was Johann Salomon, and that it has been proven that many Jewish Hitlers lived there, and that the Rosalie Mueller maiden name of Hutler is written on a tombstone in the Jewish cemetery in Polna. After annexation of Austria into Germany, one of the first moves Hitler made was to make all the villages and cemeteries with the names of his ancestors disappear, and in their place were established military training grounds. Hitler's mother, who often called her husband Uncle Alois, was quiet and modest. She went along with everything, even with the move to Lindstrasse in Braunau soon after the baby was born. She knew the routine. Before the wallpaper on one apartment dried out, her Alois was ready to move to another. The new apartments were mostly darker and moister, but for him, the main reason for change was to move on and on. This time they moved to the border town of Passau, where the Austrian customs officer had a branch on the imperial German soil. They did not anticipate to stay there for long, and therefore moved their boy Adolf, not yet of school age, speaking Bavarian slang, high, this is in quotations, high German dialect, close to Yiddish, Daish, i.e. Yiddish, in the city of Linz, which he loved all his life very much. When Alois retired, he bought a house on a farmland in Heifel at the river Traun, and at his quiet spot with a creek between Linz and Salzburg, he raised bees and was a good neighbor. When all the furniture had been put in place, he sold the property and moved in to the nearby town of Lambach. First into the house number 58, later he rented a space in a smith mill which belonged to the miller Zabel. Soon his son became the school age and was taken in by the closest one grade village school in Fischham. He was very good in drawing. Besides, he sang loudly and expressively. In his way, the Lambach Seminary acquired a new choir student. Lambach Seminary was a mighty, long-stretched Baroque building dominating over the entire village. In Lambach's Trinity Church, also a magnificent Baroque building, he was promoted to a mass server and was proud of his colorful gown. For centuries, the abbots of the Lambach Benedictine Monastery were and still are carrying the swastika on their coat of arms. Here the boy for the first time heard about the Jews as God's murderers, who had the Master and Redeemer tortured and nailed to a cross. Carpenter Joseph Ransmier, in whose arms Hitler's father died one morning in the inn of Wiesinger of Londin, quote, "When I was about 10 or 12 years old lad, I always had to go to the stinky bars," unquote. Hitler reported later to his lawyer, Dr. Hans Frank, about the relationship with his hated half-Jewish father. "It was the most disgusting shame I had ever had to experience." At this Catholic church, its radiance overwhelmed him. It was an experience which never occurred in his home. This caused deep admiration towards the church lasting throughout his life. Often, and quite successfully, he did not pay any taxes, but not to the church, to which he paid ardently. Even in 1945, Lambach's monastery educated him to its full ability, and his 60-year-old father added his own discipline to the student. But despite the rigid upbringing, to a dismay of his teacher, the student smoked cigarettes, for which he was extensively beaten. Many times he ran for protection to his mother, to whom he was very attached. When his father commanded him to become a government servant, he rebelled and intentionally lowered his school grades. Simply like that, Adolf Hitler decided to live accordingly to his inclinations and to despise ordinary work. From there, the family moved to Leonding, closer to Linz, where his father forced him to enter the Linz Imperial Royal State School, from which, in the first year of attendance, he flunked out. The boy was lazy and read only Karl May stories during the class hours. The retired Imperial Royal Customs officer did not witness any further Adolf's failures, for while visiting Wiesinger Bar in January 1903, he had a stroke and died there in the arms of Ransmier, a carpenter, also a frequent attendant to the said bar. Then the widow put her son into the boarding school in Linz. One of the Catholic governesses there was from the same forest as Hitler, and because it was difficult to train the boy, they called him a Jewish rascal. 2 years later, his mother moved into a small apartment in Linz, but Hitler had to go on after he repeated an exam. The Linz Real School transferred him to the fourth grade under a condition that he goes to another school. From those Linz times, he remembered well only a history teacher, Dr. Poetsch, a native of the southern border country. He was a fighter for the nationhood and held an opinion that the state of Habsburg was un-German. In the district council, he represented a German national parliamentary group. After annexation of Austria in 1938, Hitler saw the aging Poch again. He spent 1 hour with him and told the people waiting outside the door that you have no idea how much I owe to this old man. Adolf Hitler had to leave Linz and went to state high school in the south part of Steyr. There in the house of Ignaz Kammerhofer at the Green Market Plaza, people had mercy on him. His first school report from the Stiers Institute was so unusually bad that they sneaked off with other suffering comrades to a faraway bar. And when they got drunk, their mouths opened up. They called teachers bureaucratic bums. And at the bar, an already insignificant report lost its face value. Since then, he could only please excuse the expression, wipe with the bottom of with it. Someone found this document, and in February 1905, it landed in the desk of the institute director, and its remark was still readable, that within 6 months period, he missed 30 school days without any explanation. The situation got worse after a conversation with the institute's director, Libida. Student Adolf Hitler solemnly swore never to drink again. Since then, Hitler's health condition worsened, and everyone, but mostly himself, was happy with this 16-year-old boy had ended his academic efforts. This was a new opportunity to drive with his mother back home deep into the forest land to visit his aunt. There he drank lots of milk, ate well, and quickly recovered. The following spring saw him in museums and opera of Vienna. Later came Linz, filled with his drawings, paintings, and poems. He lived there in a furnished room provided by his mother in her residence. He also took piano lessons, and for 2 years, in the shallowness of easy life, he felt very comfortable. Once came to his attention a blondish, well-built girl named Stephanie. At 5 o'clock every afternoon, he waited for her in shiny clothes at the corner of Smithgate. There, this beautiful girl usually strolled with her mother. Her very smile made him happy. He never talked to Stephanie. In his letters, he referred to her via a disguised name as Benkeiser. In English, that's Candy Kid. In Hebrew, Daish, after his Jewish classmate. An upholstery businessman named Kabezek, who was just as excited about operas as Hitler, was his only friend, and because of that, Hitler was treated by him as a front runner. During the long walks, Kabezek listened patiently to his oratories. For Stephanie shall get a huge brand new house in Renaissance style with a music room, with acoustics that should be very important, quote, but where the piano should be placed, unquote. Financially broken student asked his friend Kivodik for an advice, daring to mention money. Quote, but what is money? Asked the confident man, being convinced that such wash rags are easy to get with or without decent occupation. When Stephanie did not laugh anymore like before, because some young lieutenant, those vain hollowheads, courted her, Adolf Hitler decided to jump off the bridge into the Danube, and of course Stephanie should jump with him. But neither one jumped, so the story as well as the history of the world went on undisturbed. In the fall of 1907, the young man decided to drive to Vienna, where, according to his inclinations, he wanted to be a painter, a really graduate painter. When a suitcase filled with books, mainly about German heroes, was ready to be taken away, his mother entered the room, and on the arm of her son, lying in bed, she put her hand a few months earlier, this careworn woman had undergone surgery for breast cancer. And so at this moment, she muttered, quote, "Listen, your father," and faltered. Then she sat up straight, cramped her hands together, quote, "Today I will tell you everything." She started quietly, quote, "When you will need this address in Vienna, your father's mother became pregnant when she was over 40 years old. She was working in Graz for Mr. Frankenberger, a Jew who came from Hungary and later on moved to Vienna. A son was born out of this affair who is your father. The Frankenberger family paid child support for Alois until he was 14 years old. Then he learned to be a shoemaker. The Frankenbergers always wrote letters and often sent presents. They are noble people. Here, take the Frankenberger's address in Vienna. He is your uncle, maybe." And here she stopped. The terminally ill woman put a piece of paper under the pillow, kissed her son's forehead, and left, closing the door quietly. That night he stayed awake for a very long time, and in the morning his friend Kubizek carried the heavy suitcase to the train station. 3 months later, the Vienna vagabond returned to Linz. He was pale, scrawny, and hollow-eyed. "Incurable," said the family doctor, Block, a Jew. To this remark, the young man reacted furiously. Quote, "What does this mean? The sickness is not curable, or is it so for the doctors that do not want to cure it?" Unquote. Then the depressed son rolled up his sleeves, scrubbed his mother's home, heated it, and cooked her favorite meals. In 1907, 3 days before Christmas, the 47-year-old woman passed away, and 2 days later the funeral procession moved through the foggy streets near Danube. The 18-year-old lad, dressed in a long black winter coat, carried a cylinder hat in one hand and followed the procession. In the second hand, he held Paula, his 11-year-old sister. The Jewish Dr. Block, in his career of 40 years, has never seen such a broken-hearted and sorrowful young man. During this long, silent, and holy night, this lonely man walked through the streets of Linz until the twilight came. And that's the end of chapter 1. We're going to go to chapter 2 now. Try to remember as much of this as you can. Adolf Hitler, shortly before he took over the care of his terminally ill mother, had failed the exam in the General Painter's School in Vienna. This rejection hit him like a thunderbolt out of a clear sky. Broken and desperate, he left the magnificent building at Schillerplatz in the province. He was by far the best artist in his class. But this was Vienna, population of 2 million. Flunked it was, a well-known, he wandered through the Jewish cemetery of Vienna in search of a grave and found several tombstones with the name Frankenberger and others with the name Hitler. Then he bought a postcard in the Vienna synagogue and spent a whole day painting it in aquarelle successfully. Next morning he got a caftan. In the afternoon proceeded nicely dressed through the well-maintained garden at the Villa of Frankenberger in Heidzing. A girl opened a door and led him into the parlor. In the corner across from the large carpet stool, an armchair. On top of it, he put the package with his drawings and aquarelle of the synagogue. Then he looked closely at the paintings of Frankenberger's ancestors hanging on the wall. They had the same, a little bit too big, curved nose, which he has too, and which his half-brother Alois and his half-sister Angel, Angela, also have, although they are born from different mother. Then Mr. Frankenberger entered, a man in his 60s, well-kept and nourished. As the young Hitler noticed, he had the same family mark, a big nose. Adolf, having been encouraged, started to introduce himself. He spoke fluently and said what he wished. Quote, "Your family, your honorable father, your grandfather, they did so much good for my old master father. Let God bless him forever. His son, who is now completely alone in the world, needs your help. I do not ask for money. Help me get into the academy. You are so powerful." The old Frankenberger put down his cigar and plodded across the parlor. "Listen, young friend," he stated. "Our side has paid for your father. That is true. But no one can say that the begetter came from our side. I am talking about my father and who said that he was. About your grandmother, let us talk no more." He moved his hand through the air as the young Hitler stood there with his mouth open. "Listen," Frankenberger said again, "I'm not a patron of the arts. I do not know anything about it. Wait," he recalled something. "Here in Vienna, we have a kitchen for our old people. Do you want to do something there?" At this moment, Hitler took his folder, bowed, and left without a word. He ran out into the street, paused, took the synagogue ochlor, tore it apart, and threw the pieces over the fence. He continued running, stopped again, ripped the black kaftan off his body, turned back, and threw the garment to where the pieces of the aquarelle laid. It got caught by a bush of withering red roses. Quote, "I will send all of you back to the desert," he threatened in his Bavarian jargon and rose his first fist up. "Go back to where you came from. I will send you all to the desert, all of you." Two passing people hearing this stopped in wonder. The lad further, with his coattail flapping in the wind, "He will make it without any help. He will work for himself until the next autumn and be an independent man." And so Adolf Hitler started looking for support again. It came from a lady, a homeowner in Linz. Her mother knew Professor Alfred Roller of the Vienna Art Academy, who knew the sculptor Panholzer. The sculptor agreed to prepare the young downfallen talent for an exam in 1908. Hitler wanted to have his friend Kubizek in Vienna. Why didn't this guy study music? Should this talented man shrivel in Linz? For the first time at Kubizek's father's upholstery business, Hitler put his talent of speech and power of persuasion to serious test. Kubizek wanted to pass the tiredly built business on to his only son. The music vocation, a great career as a conductor, a dusty lungs illness, and an early death of an upholsterer, all these contentions Hitler took into account. And in February 1908, he wasn't alone anymore in Vienna. He thought this as he led his just-arrived friend through the train station across the Mariahilferstrasse. Through side streets to Stumpergasse, number 29, and to the backyard where he would share his meager room in the house of widow Zacharys, a woman from Bohemen, with his Linz companion who was supposed to study music in Vienna. The room in the house smelled like petroleum. The next morning, when Hitler was sleeping, Kubizek went to the conservatory, took an exam, and passed it. When he returned and awoke Hitler, it was already noon. Kubizek was studying efficiently and successfully, and soon he earned her money. As a tutor, he gave music lessons to daughters of higher society. At the same time, Hitler studied under the sculptor Panholzer, but less than enthusiastically. There was something that bothered him. Who was his grandfather? How did his grandmother live? Being over 40 years old, did she really give herself to a 19-year-old son of the masters that Frankenberger. What a terrible disgrace it was, the seduction of hundreds of thousands of girls by bow-legged, disgusting Jewish bastards. The opera was luring him in, and he still had enough money to stay in place. After he read what Wagner had once confessed to Nietzsche, Wagner, the philosopher, that he really was a biological son of his stepfather, the Jewish actor Ludwig Geyer. He didn't miss any of his performances. So Wagner, too, the maker of Nordic Mist, was a Jew. Hitler, like Wagner, Wagner also had to fight to overcome the Jewishness in him. Thus, Wagner's grave and Bayreuth became to Hitler, who grew up to be a man, the sites of pilgrimage, and his later to be a chief ideologist, Rosenberg, who also descended from a Jewish immigrant to Sweden and became a member of the aristocracy there, shouted with joy. Bayreuth is the completion of the aristocratic myth. The essence of the whole art of Occident has been revealed through Richard Wagner. The beauty, northern beauty, the deepest feeling of nature, the heroical honor, and an expression of sincerity. So in this direction was going an always hungry and defeated young Hitler. From now on, he was too wanted to move into Valhalla, the Hall of the Slain, after a heroic life. And above his bed, he hung the saying painted by him artistically. Quote, "We look freely and openly. We look steadfastly. We look joyfully to the German fatherland, Heil." Since then, he preferred the study of the Jewish question over the study of art. During many nights, Kubizek, the student of music, had fallen asleep over his friend's expositions. At such moments, Hitler woke him up and shouted, "Are you my friend or aren't you?" Getting Kubizek to nod, "So listen on." For days, Hitler lived on milk and bread alone. Once Kubizek invited him to a cafeteria and for a couple of marks bought him a pudding, his favorite dessert. "Does it taste good?" asked the worried Kubizek. His grumpy answer was, quote, "I don't understand how you can enjoy such food next to these people," unquote. Those people were Jewish music students, and Hitler withdrew to a corner and turned his back on them. "But you like to listen to the two Jews, Gustav Mahler and Mendelssohn," Bart Holdy argued the seeking truth, Kubizek. "Come with me," was the answer, and the obeying Kubizek went alongside Hitler, thus saving money on the expensive cable cars. Their way led to the Brigenau, and from there to a synagogue. Hitler knew his way from earlier visits there. "Keep your hat on," he grumbled, and they both took part in a Jewish wedding. The musically inclined Kubizek was hoping to divert his friend's attention from the matter he was stubbornly attaching himself to, but despite his efforts, came out a declaration, quote, "Today I have joined an anti-Semite group, and I enrolled you too." A few days earlier, Hitler gave the police a deposition with this content, quote, "In the Maria Hilfer Strasse, in front of the Gerngross department store, a merchant's begging. He's an Eastern Jew dressed in boots and coat. He offers shoelaces and buttons. Begging was prohibited, and Hitler claimed that he was solicited. Other people claimed the same, and they took the intimidated Jew to the guard station, where the policeman pulled 3,000 crowns from his kaftan's pocket. To Hitler, this was a fortune. At the same time, he would be painter, who had prepared himself for an entrance exam, was writing a poem. At the conservatory, Kubizek made acquaintance with a journalist from the Wiener Tagblatt, the Vienna Daily. One day he said that he will be able to deliver to him a novel. at a later date, Kubicek, together with Hitler, brought the novel to his journalist friend at Lagasse Strasse. It bore a title, The Next Morning. Hitler glanced at the journalist, immediately turned his back, and yelled at the good-deeding friend, quote, "You idiot, don't you see that he is a Jew?" Unquote. In the fall of 1908, the new exam, Hitler failed again. He wasn't admitted to the test drawing. At that time, Kubicek served 2 months in the military, even though Hitler advised him not to enlist. For in the life of a young musician, it will leave a blank space. When he returned to Vienna, his old friend Adolf was gone. He disappeared and could not be found again. He left nothing behind, not even a bid farewell, asked the astonished Kubicek, while the old woman Zacharys only shook her head with regret. In Schönbrunner Park stood a bench where Hitler, hungry for air and sun, usually withdrew to. It just happened that a man named Grill walked by, and glancing there at the bench, saw lying around anti-Semitic flyers, mainly Ostara magazines. After a short hesitation, he sat down on the clear spot and pulled out of his coat a reproducing written, saying, quote, "Here, take this. It's a gift from me," unquote. Hitler took a look at him and then the writing entitled Against the Church's Official Machinery. It turned out that Grill, with the help of his writings, was trying to promote among people a religion of real and pure love. When Hitler started talking about the Jews as people's parasites, who always are against good intentions, they met themselves at the subject. In this way, the two zealots found each other. At last, someone appeared who followed Hitler and who could be challenged in a political discussion and who would not submissively nod like Kubicek. Grill came to this spot and promoted his teachings about true love almost every day. Hitler agreed with him, with one exception, that the Jews should be left out. Grill was a dropout priest who had spent his youth in a Catholic monastery, and his point of view on this matter was different from Hitler's. One day, when their discussion reached a zenith, Grill suddenly confessed, quote, "I was born a Jew. My father was a rabbi," unquote. Since then, Hitler's bond with these people became stronger and lasted for years. Finally, Hitler moved to a cabin in the men's hostel at the Mendelstrasse, where Grill made a living by addressing envelopes. From this traitor of Jewishness and of Catholic Church, Hitler could learn a lot. During long walks through the parks, they exchanged opinions with each other. Grill taught his new friend Yiddish, too. They also walked for hours through the inner city and district north of the Danube Channel, where Jews were numerous and easy to observe. Among mostly 2 million residents of Vienna, about 200,000 were Jews. That is 10%. They spent many evenings and nights with Grill's friends, the Jewish rabbis, and talked with them until their heads got hot. Hitler wanted to learn from their dialectics and got acquainted with this precept. Quote, "First you must take into account the lack of wisdom of your adversary. If it is useless, look for a way out and pretend that you're a dummy. If this doesn't work either, then switch to a different subject and claim that everything is self-understandable." Thus he learned a lot. To Grill, all people were alike, all good. Quote, "There are rabbits with blue eyes, rabbits with red eyes. They're all good." "No," Hitler argued. "Rabbits with red eyes belong to a bad race, and Jews are of a bad race." Then Hitler wanted to visit the Holy Cross and Cistercian Monastery in Wienerwald to get the address of Mr. Lance, the publisher of Ostara magazines, i.e., to the messenger of the new racial order. In 1899, out of this monastery came Adolf Joseph Lance, also known as Brother George. He united with a Jewess, Liebenfels, and since then called himself Dr. George Lance von Liebenfels. Later on, he rose his father, Lance, an upright Vienna teacher, to the nobility title of Baron. About his mother, born Hopfenreich, whose father was a Jew, he kept a conspicuous silence. Since 1905, he distributed Ostara magazines, which sometimes reached a circulation of 100,000. Their Ostara dealt with Mary Madonna, who was the progenitor of the royal blonde Aryan heroic race. Jesus was promoted to the Nordic Frau, god of plenty. And since then, Hitler constantly wondered whether the natural father of the Savior was a traveling Greek artist or a Germanic soldier. Lance saw a difference between light blonde heroic sons and ape people, who he did not consider women. Later, Hitler summarized his religious madness in his bestseller book as follows, quote, "People's state must begin by rising marriage from the level of continuous defilement of the race and give consecration, oh, this institution which was established for the creation of images of the Lord and not monasteries, monstrosities, halfway between man and ape." The Ostara magazine printed on its front covers, "Are you blonde? Are you male? If you do not know, then read Ostara's library about blonde and legitimate males," unquote. An ordinary anti-Semite doesn't like a Jew out of envy or vanity, or just because he was raised that way. He has nothing against the Arabs. The real anti-Semite knows next to the Jews, there are Arabs and Abyssinians who are Semites too. So through Lance, Hitler became a true anti-Semite. In the monastery of the Holy Cross, the two young men found the Vienna address to this widely exposed sectarian, and to the beginning of 1909, the incoherent Hitler appeared before him in his city office, besides the missing issues of Ostara magazine. Lance von Liebenfels also gave the visitors 2 kronen to drive home. Hitler accepted this gift eagerly during a certain conversation in a Vienna cafe under the Golden Bullet. Grill was firm and said, "This fellow is a nut," and from there on he stayed away from Hitler. In the Ostara magazines, 1908 and 1909 were given instructions on how to measure body parts, and from then on could find out whether one has some Nordic traits, like the length and strength of the big toe of a heroic person sticks out from all the other toes, with accompanied pictures of buttocks shapes. It showed a lower and a higher race. This was a happy day in the poor life of young Hitler, for after thorough measurements, he found himself to be predominantly Nordic bloodline. Really, this Lance was his man. Because of Lance's medical achievements, men important in public life visited him frequently. To them, for instance, belonged a Swedish author, August Strindberg, and his English lord in rank, a British field marshal, nobleman Herbert Kitchener, who assured him that he will keep the stage racially clean and will send the colored ruthlessly into the fire, unquote. In Switzerland, Lance von Liebenfels met Lenin. Because Lance thought differently, he addressed his opinion in fine irony. Quote, "Your ideas are right, but before they materialize, our counter-ideas will materialize first," unquote. That's how Lance was a partner in conversation to the two men, the men who shocked the first half of our century intensely. The most important statement of the Vienna reformer of the world was, "We counter-revolutionaries give Jews the right to create their own state in Palestine." Lance von Liebenfels established a Thule Order society, and with the money coming from the various sources, created Orders Castles. In 1907, above the Castle Werfenstein, he hoisted up a swastika flag. Hitler, for upbringing of his party elite, created a similar castle. Inset Führer Hitler was a member of the Thule Order, Beber Hitler Com, page 246. Lance also granted to the blonde men a right to inseminate several women. Hitler was also happy because of the Villa Obersalzburg. Quote, here in Berchtesgaden country, I found a jumbled up population. Thanks to my bodyguards, from now in this area, strong and healthy children will be running around. Free love. There he goes, free love. Uncle Adolf, you naughty boy. Lance preached castration and sterilization of inferior races. It can't be said that Hitler missed any of Lance's tenets. Both had to repress to cover up something in the line of their ancestry, and that how these men found each other, and while one gave up his ideas, the other took them eagerly. This is what Lance von Liebenfels wrote to his brother, Amelius, on February 22, 1932, 1 year before Hitler came to power. Quote, do you know that Hitler is our best student? You will see that he and through him, we, too, will succeed and will stir up a movement which will make the whole world shiver. Heil you! A very special influence over the 20-year-old Hitler had two outstanding Jewish adversaries, the Ritter, von Schorner, and his followers, lawyer Dr. Luger, who became mayor of Vienna. Hitler devoured their writings and manifestations like he did with the Ostara magazines. The difference between Schorner and his all-German union, borrowed from Caesar, and Vienna's elected mayor, Dr. Luger, with his Christian Social Party, was what Schorner asserted, quote, a Jew stays a Jew, unquote, to which Luger counter-argued, quote, Christ is a baptized Jew, unquote. At that time, Hitler was distributing flyers for Luger. There was no difference of opinion between these two leading Austrian Jewish antagonists as to selection of Jews or half-Jews for their closest cooperatives. For Schorner, first in line was the Galician author Karl Emil Frenzos. For the later, it would be the Social Democrat Viktor Adler, co-author of Lindt's Great German Program, One People, One Empire. Next was Heinrich Friedjung from Meidren, also a Jew. Luger's representative was Vienna's second mayor and half-Jew, Porzer. The famous saying, quote, I will determine who is a Jew, came from Dr. Luger. From their work, years before the establishment of the NSDAP of Munich, originated the National Socialist German Workers' Party of Sudetenland. Karl Wolff, previously a parliamentarian for Schorner, was party establisher. However, Schorner was thinking in terms of race, but not a socialist. Luger was a socialist and therefore anti-Jewish, but not a racist. That's how the two men parted. From one man, Hitler took the concept of race. From the other, he took socialism. However, Schorner was thinking, In Hitler's eyes, Dr. Luger was the most powerful German mayor of all times. And also, in 1945, the newly emerging socialists of Vienna associated this Jewish opponent with themselves. Everything that was created at that time bore Luger's personal note, had originated out of his own initiative, and were decreed by him. Dr. Luger became the man who paved the way for the communal socialism, which is as an outcome of the productive strength of the Socialist Workers' Party of Vienna, was supposedly fruit 10 years after Luger's death. Young Hitler was not all right with the Socialist Workers' Party in Vienna. Shortly before Kubizek's return from the military, he had moved to the Felberstrasse in the 15th District. When he didn't appear at the draft inspection, and therefore violated Austrian military law, he moved into a hut at the Seckhauser Strasse. And 1 month later, he was a subtenant at the Simon Dinkgasse. That's how the money, which came from the low orphan pension and from small inheritances, disappeared. After several nights in the coffee shops, he ended up in the working district Meidling in the homeless shelter, which was built with Jewish means. He had to work at construction sites to prevent himself from starving. At the lunch breaks, his temporary worker told elders about the exploitation people by Jewish homeowners who live in Heitzing and by drunk Jewish employers in Grenzing, because workers believed the Jewish press, which promised them jobs and bread, they threatened to push the young orator off the scaffold. So he gave up and treated this experience of work for bread as a lesson which he never forgot. The snow was falling, and with snow shuffling the careworn failure made it through the winter. In the monastery at Gompendorsestrasse, a soup for poor people was given out in the mornings. At noon, the warm room of the Jewish Baron Königswachter offered shelter from the cold and a warm meal. In the evenings, at the homeless shelter, there was enough to eat, a piece of horse sausage and a crust of bread. And then came a long night on a hard-wired plank bed with shoes and a few belongings stuck under the head, while a thin blanket and jacket kept the body warm. On the other plank-led bed laid Reinhold Hanisch, a commercial artist of Sudetenland and a property owner who had to disappear within the walls of Vienna under his cover name, Fritz Walter. Hanisch noticed Hitler's talent for painting and got an idea. Quote, "You will paint cards and I will sell them. Christmas is coming and we will earn some cash," unquote. Hitler painted well and with care. Hanisch distributed the hand-painted postcards among various coffee houses and bars, and the trade was booming. By Christmas, they both were out of the worst and joined Grill, living in the men's hostel at Meldemannstrasse in the 20th district. For half a crown, they could rent a room for one day and one night. Failures dismissed officers, impoverished earls, bankrupt merchants, and semi-painters rented there for days and weeks and months. In such a school of life, Hitler celebrated his birthday four times. From postcards, Hitler switched to picture painting, mostly aquarellas, and Hanisch found thankful buyers among the furniture merchants and carpenters. They requested little pictures that could be put on the back of sofas. So Hanisch pushed the painter, for earnings were dependent on his efficiency. The stuff was easy to sell, but Hitler painted only when he needed the money for rent, milk, rice, and so on. Most of the time he was sitting upstairs in the reading room of the men's hostel reading newspapers or gave political speeches. The subject was always the same, but listeners changed. In the evenings, the homecoming Hanisch would always interrupt with thunder, "Finally, go to work." And others exclaimed ironically, "To work, Hitler, to work, your boss is coming." Hitler's objection to an artist is not a ballpoint pen, but needs inspiration. Didn't matter to Hanisch, artist through hunger at most. That bothered me, that putting in there about the ballpoint pen, because ballpoint pens were not around, I don't think, at that time. Maybe he doesn't mean that, but anyhow, the artist had commenced a falsification of his art. He brown-roasted old Vienna pictures in his married older sister's oven in Vienna and stored them for a while in her moist basement, usually a little bit too long, and because of that, nobody wanted to purchase such moldy stuff. Hitler, when wearing a dark kaftan, looking like a frock coat, with a Hungarian Jew Newman, a cabin neighbor, once gave him, and because of a fluffy beard around his chin and weaving hair on his neck, was mistaken by some newcomers for an Eastern Jew. Even Hanish mocked at him. At one time your father must not have been at home. Look at your shoes. They are of the Wilderness Wanderer brand. But at that time the young artist didn't care about his appearance. Once, after almost 1 year of working together, Hanish did not claim the money for a picture he had sold. Hitler, after giving some thought to his evasion of military duty, reported to the police commissar at Brigenau what Hanisch had done. Thus, Hanisch was prosecuted in an effort, in effect, had to move to another location. It's interesting that a couple of times here already, Hitler had been an informant on people. And when, of course, he came out of the First World War, he was still working for the military, and he was told to go out and infiltrate the new Workers' Party and report to the military about them. The right wing glosses over that by saying, well, he liked it so much that he took it over. Well, that's partially true, maybe, just like some police informants have done in this country. Then Newman, a Jew from Hungary, who was more able to bargain, became Hitler's new painting salesman. It was the same Jew who gave him the frock coat. Purchasers of paintings were mostly Jewish, as, for example, the Hungarian Jew Retzsche, a main engineer, the Vienna lawyer Dr. Joseph Feingold, and the picture frame merchant Morgenstern. Another cabin neighbor who stayed in the hostel even longer was Greiner, a young man who a short time before his ordination broke with the priesthood and now made a living from his paintings. He also was Grill's friend, who was still living in the men's hostel. Many times the three men gathered and cooked their milk with rice, even taking turns in stirring. A girl named Gretel was Greiner's model, and Hitler also claimed, yes, to have known her very well. When the mother of the blooming beauty discovered scratch wounds and bite marks on her body caused by Hitler, the modeling was finished. To balance this out, Gretel was suddenly engaged to a baptized Eastern Jew. In response, that man received a letter from Hitler, quote, a German girl who fraternizes with the villains of the shameful, filthy money mongers and who offers herself to a stinky, bristly, black, and wild-pig Jew is a disgrace. The only thing that is morally right for a Jew is to marry a Jewish Rebecca or to fry that obese goose Jewess. Only then will she wonder about the miraculous German heroism. Hitler stranded in the men's hostel to satisfy human or male needs in the evenings, ran occasionally through the streets of Leopold City, where girls were waiting and willing to help. And who was behind all this? The icy, cool, likewise shameless, and efficient conductors of this business, a Jew. In the coffee shop of Vienna, the young Hitler was known as an efficient specialist who unnoticeably could place fishes, air sacks filled with red ink under the seats of plump Jewish girls. When the sacks ruptured, the ensuing embarrassment was enormous. All of his life, Hitler knew very well... Just a minute here. Whoop. We're almost through with the show here. I got another page. All of his life, Hitler knew very well how to discern between the highly educated, tall Western Jews and the Eastern, constantly streaming in, trading, and jabbering those Kafkan Jews. I remember reading in another book, before Hitler, that these tall, more integrated Western Jews were appalled at these seedy, little, swarthy, kinky-haired Jews that were coming into the country and setting up little tables on the street and doing their money changing on the street. There was a lot of difference between them. This big difference in many centuries-old enmity between both groups was fully clear to him. When the First World War was lost, Polish Jews populated Berlin in masses. It was Rathenau, the Jewish foreign minister of the Weimar Soviet Republic, who talked about Asian hordes on the Brandenburger's Märkische sands. So he conspicuously agreed with Hitler and wrote, quote, one must walk the way and of nature is the walking, i.e., the way of nortification. A new romance will come, romance of the race. It will glorify and pure northern blood and will create new concepts of virtue and vice. The main appearance of our time is the mixing of the races, and with this, degradation of character. After a dozen years of this experience with those poor trouser dealers in Vienna, this Fazizia city of parasites, the embodiment of disgrace and incest, Hitler pointed out, quote, of course, they do not look like these in Linz, these Jews. Throughout centuries, their appearances here became European and human, unquote. Remember that point. In Linz, he was well disposed towards the Jews. In Vienna, he became their enemy and an anti-Semite. The rising Zionism enhanced Hitler's curiosity. This movement came to the forefront for confirmation of Jewish character, unquote. Doubts came over as to what will happen to Palestine as a Jewish state, a place of refuge for these rags, or a center of education for would-be scoundrels and crooks. The main of the battle against the Jews was clear to him, but the solution to the problem he could not yet define. Therefore, it is not true that he declared one decade later, quote, to that which I have once created, I must add a little. I need not change an iota, unquote. Grill, the Jewish monastery student, was lost, so nobody heard about a new religion which could have come from Vienna. Kubizek changed himself after the First World War. He became a municipal office clerk, a father, and in 1942, when the Second World War was about to be lost, he was a fellow member of the party, although not quite convinced. Hanisch, after this time in prison, spread many lies around the world in which numerous publicists believed. In 1938, Gestapo got a hold of him, and shortly thereafter, his jail guard found him hung from the ceiling. Hitler's friend Greiner was jailed in 1922 with an already very well-known party leader, Hitler, in the Bohemian quarter of Munich, called Stinging Nettle. There, Hitler urged him not to give anybody, not even the closest members of the party, any information about his younger days, unquote. Later, Greiner, the engineer, as an important manufacturer, met several times with Mussolini. In 1938, Heydrich's police promised him an induction into a concentration camp in case he were to break his oath of silence. In 1947, Americans collected Greiner's memory book and destroyed all the available copies. Lance von Liebenfels received a letter from Rosenberg prohibiting him from delivering or driveling with a blonde woman of a penitentiary under the excuse that, quote, the nature gave us women as slaves, unquote. And although a bell has not yet rung yet on the biggest clock, before anything else, his task was to promote Hitler's aim of founding a Jewish state in Palestine. In 1954, Lance also considered himself a victim of the Nazi regime. When he left his grateful school with the late last sacrament of the Catholic Church, in this hard school of life in association with Eastern Jews, with people of mixed Jewish blood, with religious sectarians, petty dealers and loafers of backyards and filthy kitchens, coffee shops, and men's hostel in Vienna, Adolf Hitler prepared ground for the materialization of a goal of his entire life, to get rid of the Jews by any means possible, first from Germany and then from Europe. And that's the end of chapter 2, and I'll be back tomorrow with more. It's starting to get a little more interesting, but you can see why do they get rid of these books of people who knew Hitler before when he was young? That's a good question. The right-wingers would say it's all lies, it's all lies. Tomorrow is She-Wolf Day in the bunker. We'll be back here and see if we can find a nice lovey-dovey song, or maybe a valiant woman warrior song. But we'll be back, and 14.5, and keep your mouth shut.